Inspector.
All right, thank you. You have a good written report in front of you. I was looking through it last night and wanted to call out a few things. On page 3, that's an amazing photo. I don't know what kind of car that is. It looks like a Honda to me, but it's interesting. The duties is assigned that our officers get to be involved in a 600-pound California Sea Lion on top of a cord or something like that. I would guess it's quite a dent in top of that thing, but that was just an interesting one that caught my eye. On page 4, the website redesign, this is going to be a major project, and it's something we worked on for a couple of years now. We have a lot of staff involved. We have a contractor now. The website is, you know, obviously of increasing importance all the time, and for it to be more accessible and more user-friendly, I think will be a tremendous thing for the department, and looking forward to seeing that. Someone said the other day we have 6,000 or 9,000 pages of information.
9,000
pages of information. So to catalog and provide that in a way that people can access would be a challenge of itself. But there's a lot of things that it'd just be great if people could access more efficiently. The next page, 5, please take some time to look at our new licensing database. This is going pretty well. Anytime you have change, there's some hiccups, but it was up and running, and we were able to sell licenses over the weekend, and it's been improving ever since. One thing that's a little bit different is we've added a security layer, so you have to establish a username and ID, and that's a good thing, considering what happened to us last summer. But it also slows things down a bit, and it's some users aren't used to having to do that. And then if you're like me, it's another password to try to remember and another username. So please jot all that stuff down in your secret book. And anyway, but I'm really happy with how that's all been going. Also, then just on the back page, I think take a look at that at this hatchery improvement. We really have some talented staff on board with our capital, or in our capital program, and I'm very proud of the work that they do. They're a fun group to talk to, and they've really become expert in certain types of construction that are kind of unique to our profession. And this fish ladder is just one of them. But the different kinds of hatchery maintenance and water handling stuff that we do are pretty unique to Fish and Wildlife agencies, and they do a terrific job. A couple other items I wanted to touch on. First off is our legislative package, and I want to give you just kind of a briefing of where we're at with some of our agency request legislation. First, our aquatic invasive species bill, it's had hearings in both the House and Senate, and it's moved out of the policy committees and it's gone to appropriate. So that's making some progress. We did end up amending that and rolling back some of the fees associated with it. Certainly, we don't want to give up the opportunity to make some or to gain some ground on fees, but we had to make those compromises to make the legislation move. So. Anyway, it's made some traction. The recreational immunity, both of them have had hearings in the committees, but neither have moved out of those policy committees. So we'll have to watch that one. The same with hydraulic project approvals. Both Senate and House have had hearings, but neither committee has moved that out of their committee. Commercial fee bill, we do not have a Senate bill, but the House bill has moved out of committee and to appropriate, so that's good. We had a hearing on the recreational fees yesterday in House Agner, and it was a very good hearing. We had 25 people testify. A couple of people were opposed, outright opposed. Several were opposed to the bill as written, but I think to a person, people wanted to work with us to amend that legislation and move forward. So I'm encouraged that we'll be able to put together a funding package that will work for the majority of people, and we'll be able to see some movement on that. So right now at lunchtime, I'm going to go over and work with the prime sponsor. Staff is over there right now. We're trying to put together a package that will maybe meet the needs of the people that we've heard from so far. So we had a pretty aggressive package as our first draft. We have a little bit of room to do some, make some changes. And so we're continuing to listen and work with folks, and we'll see what we can do on that.
Proviso?
Pardon me?
The proviso? The task force?
Oh, yeah, that's... Oh, I was going to talk about that in just a little bit later, yeah. Yeah. Want to mention a couple of things on the...
Yeah. Just a quick question on the recreational access bill that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Was there opposition to the bill? And if so, can you describe the nature of the opposition?
We've run into some oppositions from the trial lawyers.
Okay.
Association. And maybe you could tell us why they would do that.
Well, I No, I'm not a trial lawyer, but my sense would be is that group is very influential, and they might view this as kind of a domino effect. You know, so if you have relaxed liability in this instance, maybe not perceived as a direct threat, but yet it's like, okay, well, then you open up Pandora's box. I mean, I don't know, but that would be kind of my speculation. So
we have reached out to them, and we're working to find out if there's a way to move this forward. So another item I wanted to mention, as we've been working the recreational fee bill part of this, one of our representatives, Representative Litton, requested some more specific information of her ask was, what's it look like specifically if you don't get a fee bill? And so that's a really difficult thing to answer because in the past, legislators have, when we have done that kind of exercise and laid out these are the hatcheries that we would be most likely to do something, then that can... You receive a real negative reaction for that you're trying to hold us hostage. On the other hand, people need to know what kind of specifics we would do if we don't have funding. And so we put together a letter, and it's still a draft, but I wanted to just talk to you, go through some of the things, just so that we all kind of know the sorts of things we do when we get into a budget crunch. And, you know, the first things you do is just look internally and look for efficiencies. We did that in a big exercise prior to when I got here, when we had the big reduction because during the Great Recession. We're pretty tight right now, but there's always some efficiencies that you can look at and process improvements, those sorts of things, to find a little bit of extra money and you know, make your dollars go further. And then, of course, the first things you do is you have to look for positions and services that you can actually eliminate. And to do that, you go through this filter of what do we have to do as a department to meet our legal mandates, of course, meet federal and state laws, treaties and our contracts that we have, and then what are we actually doing from a voluntary basis that we could say we're not going to do that right now. So you go through that. Then the next kind of place that you find yourself is how could we save money, pinch pennies in terms of management? And so this is where some of the first places that other than outright eliminating certain programs where sportsmen start to feel maybe the pinch. I've been in situations before where we had to roll back license dollars, and so one of the big expenses is hatchery production. And so you don't want to mothball all of your hatcheries But if you can't afford to buy the fish food, you have to raise fewer fish. And so an immediate thing you can do is to reduce bag limits on hatchery trout. I mean, you can go from a 6-fish bag limit to a 2-fish bag limit, and you save money. Just boom. Other kinds of things that you do from a wildlife management standpoint, you reduce the amount of aerial surveys you do. Aerial surveys are always a big expense. Counting big game in the wintertime, very expensive helicopter time. You reduce that. All of those kinds of things put you in a mode of being more conservative managers. And so you offer fewer permits because you don't have as good or continual of information. And so that kind of puts you into this area where, you know, sportsmen don't perceive as great of opportunity, and well, there's not as great of opportunity. And those things add on themselves and get you in kind of a tough place.
Yeah, because I wanted you to translate the lack of survey to impact on our constituents, and you did that. So, thanks.
Okay. So then Representative Litton wanted to know some more specifics. I think I didn't really get into the areas in her particular area. But on this letter, and I'll share it with you, we get into some of the program level things that we would have to start looking at, you know, and a lot of these things just relate to reductions in customer service. Maybe not as quick to respond in depredation situations. Fewer nuisance wildlife. You're at a longer list for your nuisance wildlife responses from the department. In the fish program, certainly some of the needs to carefully evaluate programs in terms of meeting the obligations of the Endangered Species Act become very expensive, and when you can't do that, then you fall into this management scenario where you can't promulgate certain fisheries. One of the biggest areas we would run into is difficulties with our hatcheries and the rules or the policies we have to follow to meet hatchery genetic management plans and produce or keep fish from interfering with wild fish on spawning beds. So those sorts of things become problematic. If you have fish weirs that break down, you cannot sort fish, you end up with too many hatchery fish with competing with wild fish, you have to just roll back production. There again, you get into this kind of a tailspin with poorer fishing and those sorts of things. The habitat program, certainly we do a lot of work on the HPA being less responsive and having slower turnaround time begins to really frustrate people in communities and counties and just individual property owners. If they can't see these permits turn around, we start hearing about it in a hurry. And then just certainly capital asset programs. When you have 83 fish hatcheries, there is concrete and rebar deteriorating across the state at all times. And if you don't keep up on it from a maintenance standpoint, it costs you way, way more from a replacement standpoint. It's just kind of a fact. So those are just some general things.
Enforcement?
The enforcement. And the enforcement is really a difficult one because those dollars are are directly influenced by wildlife dollars. So really the only place to save much money in enforcement is to not fill positions. And so when you do that, we immediately hear from people if we don't have an officer in Forks or we don't have one in Ritzville or someplace like that. But at some point you have to start making or talking about priorities where an officer makes the most sense. And sometimes it leaves people without an officer. And we start hearing from local sheriff's departments is one of the first places we hear, particularly in rural Washington, where our folks work so closely with sheriff departments that we're support and they support us, and it's, we're part of a team of law enforcement in those areas. So,
well, I'm thinking of the testimony that we've been seeing around the fee bill and the complaints that mostly we've seen from recreational fishers that we're not providing opportunity, so why should they support increasing fees? And you've just described the tailspin down. It just makes me wonder how we can do a better job messaging these connections. Because as I read the testimony, it's like, we understand this, but it costs money to provide fisheries or whatever, you know, the constituent is interested in. Somehow that just doesn't, in terms of the testimony that we're seeing, that connection doesn't seem to be made. And how can we message it? I'm scratching my head and trying to come up with that.
Just a brief follow-up on that. Representative Litton was at the Wildlife Leaders Forum for 2 days, so I'm sensing that her questions about this, the part of the messaging, is positive, you know, reaching out to help us as an ally. So
anyway, it's been an interesting couple of weeks. We've had quite a few work sessions. We had an interesting Ways and Means work session. And Senator Braun had some really difficult questions and challenged me on whether or not I was gilding the lily in testimony. And I've talked to Senator Schesslers and others, and there's some validity to what they were saying. I certainly take an optimistic view, and when I see feedback from the public, I think I look at the... it's easier for me to look and think about the good things that we're doing than some of the negatives. But some of the criticism that we've gotten is very valid. People are pushed, particularly lower-income folks, on the prices of our licenses right now. I think that, we're such an important recreational component of rural Washington. And many of those people maybe aren't on the higher-income side. I hate to see us do things that gives them really hard choices when it comes to spending their recreational dollars. And so it does worry me and bother me that we're starting to push hunters and fishermen and women to the point where they're beginning to wonder if they can just afford to do that anymore. And so on the flip side of that, maybe there's a place where we can get some extra general funds, and that's certainly a part of the discussion right now. Senator Braun and I had a good discussion about that, and we'll see where that can go. But to fund this department as we move forward, we aren't going to be able to do it with just the federal dollars we have that go to very specific programs. And just based on hunter and fisher license sales, I don't think into the future. And so then we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute, but I wanted to give you that download. And we'll get you a copy of this letter when we finish it up. But I think it might be useful for you to have to communicate with
on the website design. I think, and I saw Bruce walks in here, it's important to get that message out to the ADA committee. Progress is being made. So
thank you. So few more things I just wanted to mention. The Columbia River policy, you made your decision last commission meeting. I don't know if you saw it, but Governor Kate Brown of Oregon provided some direction to their commission. Last night is when I saw it. We're meeting with Oregon on Monday to discuss where we're going to discuss how we were going to try to move forward with management. I think we'll certainly listen to how the Oregon Commission is going to approach their governor's direction, and so Either way, we'll be talking about how we'll be able to manage the Columbia. Certainly, it's gets complicated if we have different policies between the states. So,
Thank you, Director. I was going to ask you about kind of the status of things. I just saw the Governor Brown's letter this morning, and I guess my question is have you thought about the process moving forward with Oregon? I assume that there's going to be some discussions, and I would hope, you know, that both Oregon and Washington could come to some sort of agreement. I do know that that the Oregon Commission told their director that any agreement with Washington would need to be approved or brought to the commission. Just wondering if you had thought about kind of maybe doing the same thing, or just what your thoughts are on that.
On the next day after Oregon made their decision, our technical staff started getting together and discussing how are we going to do this, how are we going to manage with these different policies from our commissions. And so, yes, both of us would have to check in with the commission if we were going to make any dramatic changes that would not be within the policy. So for me to make a move a long ways in their direction, I think I would be foolish not to consult with the commission. So,
yeah, I think that would be, this is my personal view, don't mean to speak for other members of the commission, but I do think that would be, certainly I think I'm comfortable myself in letting you and staff engage in conversations, but my view is that anything would come back to the commission, and I'm glad you feel that way, and be happy to maybe curious to hear what others think if there's any other differing views. But
I agree.
Okay.
I think in the past, if we've set a policy and reality intervenes and there's a need to depart, the director has come to us in the past. I think it's going to be interesting, the conversation on Monday, because you don't know yet. Oregon doesn't know what its commission is going to do in response to the governor's letter. It's just fresh off the press. So it looks like it's going to take some time beyond the deadline that the governor set. So it's interesting.
Rather explicit deadline.
So more on that next week. The other item I wanted to mention was some good news. NIMS was able to put together its environmental impact or statement, and it got positive, or it met the needs of the Wild Fish Conservancy on the Mitchell Act hatcheries. We got the go-ahead last week that we could bill, you know, our arrears to cover the production in those hatcheries, and thank goodness, because it was over $5 million that we were holding back bills on. So anyway, that's was really good news to me and the department. We're happy to see that we've been able to, or that NIMS was able to make some management decisions to help us move forward with those Mitchell Act hatcheries.
So you said move forward too. Mm. So going forward, would you be able to maintain, or?
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag, and I probably should have one of the fisheries guys provide a an information session for the department. I don't think we have that in here, but it amounts to some reduction in production from some hatcheries, but other hatcheries we pick up a little bit. So we've also had to, it's keyed on some wares and some other management that's going to cost the department money to implement. So there again, it's kind of an unfunded mandate, I guess, if you will, for us to comply with some of that management, and I'm concerned about how we will do that. But it looks like there's a package there that will have at least it will have at least some impact on our catch of salmon up and down the coast and in the Columbia, but not as big as originally thrown out there by the proposed changes that NIMS was looking at out of the bag. In the letter that we got from Bob Jones, he specifically acknowledged Jim Scott and Eric Keeney for all the work that they did, and I want to echo that. Jim has he does an amazing amount of work, and he does it all the time with a smile on his face, and I really appreciate his efforts. So, and so do others, including Noah.
In the Noah spirit of things, there last week, Commissioner Carpenter and I met with Trout Unlimited folks, and we just wanted to. Larry was going to mention it this morning, but I'll do it to keep Occupy Skagit on the front burner, because as we're getting the calendar keeps going down, and I know that TU are good supporters of us in the their letter and the fee bill and all that. So I totally agree with keeping moving that.
Yes. Related item that I would like you to comment on, if you have some time, is the guide pilot program for the Olympic Peninsula. There was also a click-a-tat, I think, component that's probably dropping out. But we did all receive that email from John McMillan of TU. So I'd like to hear about what our stance is in relation to that.
You know, I don't know a lot of detail on that right now, and so we'd have to get back from some of the fish policy people, but I have talked to several of guides that are concerned about that legislation. It's sort of interesting. The legislation that came out on the peninsula was somewhat protective. They didn't like out-of-sight guides coming in, but then when the legislation started to be talked about, I started getting phone calls from off of peninsula guides concerned that they would be restricted. Mm-hmm. We have a really liberal policy in this state on licensing guides, and it produces a lot of good access for sportsmen that don't maybe have boats or equipment to go fishing. On the other side, you do start to get conflict issues just for competition on stream stretches between recreational and guided fishermen at some point down the road. Okay. I don't know if there's more to add to this. Maybe the fish guys could help me out. But it's something that I think that that people within that industry need to work on together. Lots of other states have approached it in different ways. In Idaho, outfitters are licensed for different stretches of river, and you're limited to the number of launches that you can make on a given stretch. Say if you're an outfitter in Lewiston, Idaho, you might only be able to have 10 launches a day between Orofino and Lewiston, and then they limit that to 20 outfitters or something on that stretch. It's done statewide. There's a outfitters and guides licensing board, and it's very much controlled there. Also on the hunting side is the same. Montana, same kind of thing. And in fact, in Montana, they've gone so far as to restricting guides and outfitters from some streams on weekends. You can't fish at all. Outfitters and guides can only fish during the week. And they've also done things like on the Madison River, where you were grandfathered in as a guide or outfitter, but you were only licensed for so many trips in a year. And that depended a bit on your longevity in the business. And so there's lots of things you can do as competition gets higher. It's great to have a lot of flexibility, because people can start small businesses and provide a lot of service. But at some point, there does become conflict. And I think that's where we're at, and was probably the stimulus for this legislation. I don't know if it's moving or will move, but...
Well, this whole topic is one of the things that I would like the full commission to take a look at, because coming from the Olympic Peninsula, I have a place in Forks, and so I fished the Quileute system for about 20 years now. And what the data that John McMillan shared with us about the effectiveness of guiding, the guides have just exploded on the Olympic, in the Quileute system in particular. So it's bumper to bumper, and which makes for less of an enjoyable experience for the rest of us, for sure. But one of the key pieces of information that I saw in one of John McMillan's emails to me was the extreme difference in effectiveness of guides versus even other private people who float boats. They get so good at knowing where the steelhead holes are that they, even though there's only about 30% of the anglers using guides, they take 75% of the steelhead. And you see that repeated in some of the other rivers. So TU's interest in this is very much driven by their conservation concern over these last best wild steelhead runs, last best in our state. The Bogashiel escapement was the lowest in decades. So they're really ringing the alarm bells here. And just because we haven't done regulation of guides in the past doesn't mean that we shouldn't in the future, because I think we've reached a turning point here. And I love for people to take it seriously and figure out what are those antecedents, those causes for the long-term decline in steelhead populations. Because I'm here to tell you, I don't see it on the habitat side. Habitat rules are more stringent than ever. For decades now, forest practices have been tightened up, land use, shoreline rules tightened up. So in the Olympic Peninsula is mostly forest lands and park. So I don't understand why we're seeing this long-term decline in steelhead populations. Raises the whole question about harvest to me. But it's worthy of more, because I don't know what the answer is. And I'm just saying, last best runs, alarm bells are ringing.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I did see the email that you forwarded to Tammy. There was a lot of information. Didn't get a chance to go through all of it. But when you mentioned the regulation of guides, I think I've thought that for a while. I think it's, and you know a lot more about what's going on the coast than I do, but I think that's a good idea. And was there, there needs to be, we just can't do it here as right. as a commission, but mm-hmm. as I think I saw that there is some draft legislation that is being floated. Do you know the status of that then, or share that?
The sense that I got from John is that they're definitely wanting to work with the industry, because they know that they've just got to talk this through. This is a very new concept. So I got the sense it's probably not going to fly this session, but it's at least the serious conversation has begun.
We may have some input, yeah.
Just to sorry, that was a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry. There was draft legislation. We've been working with Trout Unlimited on this issue for quite some time. I've had many conversations with John and his boss Rob, and we agree we need to do something, but we don't want to do anything without the right data. Mm-hmm. So one of the elements in the bill that we really liked was the establishment of a guide logbook. And we think that we need to collect this data prior to taking any actions that may not help and may actually be harmful unintentionally. And there were some technical problems with the bill that It created some new license types, and we had no definitions for those. There were a lot of concerns, as the director mentioned, from other folks, other guides. So what we want to do is bring everybody together and put a program, a pilot program together that will actually work. I don't think it's going to go anywhere this session. The bill was pulled from the hearing. There was supposed to be a hearing, as I understand it, this week. We're working with those stakeholders and the prime sponsor to work through this issue. So I just wanted you to know that the FISH program is on this. We're working very closely with these stakeholders and agree with most of the things that you said. So.
Yes.
So you remind me, I was struck as we were working on the Columbia River policy that we didn't have data on guiding and harvest from guiding. It just seems like a huge hole in our information. Do we need a statute to develop logbooks, or is that something the department could do on its own? It just seems like a huge hole to me.
Well, do we need statute? I would hope not. We may. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of support for it. We're encouraging guides to collect the data and provide it to us. Right now, what we have is anecdotal data, similar to what we heard. You know, it's bumper to bumper. Well, what does that mean, and what impacts are they having on those fish? That's the
yeah.
stuff we need.
Yeah.
I would hope that we wouldn't need legislation to get that, but we might.
Here's the man with all the answers.
He's got a gun, so I'm going to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your expectations are way too high. I don't have all the answers. But it would require statute to do something other than a voluntary logbook requirement. The last time statutes related to the guides where it was amended, we got a lot of good stuff out of that. To include requiring proof of insurance and proof of a Coast Guard operating license before this agency issues our guide license, some public safety protection measures, but unfortunately there was some language inserted that excluded a logbook requirement, so we're trying to build that back in. I think that there's a fair amount of support, from industry to do that, but to compel it would require a legislative change.
And I think what the director mentioned, too, that like some of the best practices in some of the other states, I mean, I think some of those items that you raised could be factored into this as well. And when I met with Rob at TU the other day, I mean, TU is a good partner in all of this, I think, you know, that they're looking to find something that works. So, and I share Commissioner Thornburn's concerns that we should have this.
There is a bill that was dropped, got a hearing the other day, that would deregulate fishing guides. It wasn't a real popular bill. The guides opposed that bill, but just so you know, that's in the queue. The concept is if there was some bad behavior and the public was disenchanted with a guide services, that guide would have to register with some website and sort of like Yelp, someone could complain in that fashion. And what that would effectively do would it would eliminate the leverage we have to show proof of insurance and adherence to the Coast Guard rules, and also our ability to suspend a guide for certain bad behaviors would go away. So we remain opposed to that measure, and I don't believe the guides are for it either.
Thank you, Deputy Chief.
I'm going to try to cruise through a couple of more items, and then Joe has a couple things that we definitely want to touch. But I just wanted to mention that we're working to establish a task force to implement the wildlife action plans. And this is comes out of or an outgrowth of the Wildlife Leaders Forum. In Governor Inslee's budget, he provided for provisions to establish this task force, and we're moving forward. Penny's been hard at this and's got a good plan. But this task force, we're trying to figure out what it would look like, who would be on it, and kind of what would they be tasked with. But certainly an evaluation or an assessment of fish and wildlife conservation programs and public values would be part of it. A big part of it would be to talk about sustainable funding and then how this program would mesh with the Blue Ribbon Panel on the federal level and all of those things. So more on that one. I don't want to cut it. I am going to cut it short, but I think in a future commission meeting we need to have a bigger discussion about this and spend more time on it, because I think it's going to be very important over the next two or three years. So with that, I want to turn it over to Joe. He has a couple items that you all requested more info on last time. So.
Thanks, Director, and good morning, Commissioners. Yeah, I wanted to add some exciting pieces of information to the Director's report, so we're going to talk a little bit about budget. And so first I would turn to this colored sheet that should be right in front of you.
Pretty.
Very nicely done. This was done by our licensing group. And what you have on this sheet is the last five-year trend of customer participation on one side and then actual sales revenue on the other. So I'll start with the sales side. Hunting and fishing sales. The fishing revenue is in blue on top, and the hunting revenue is in green. You can see that our revenue has been growing. And actually, if you break this down farther, we're seeing slightly reduced sales of combination licenses, but continue to see increases in two-pole and our Columbia River endorsements and shellfish license sales. The graph starts at fiscal year 12, which was the first year after our fees. We saw something like something around a 14% resistance factor that eroded over time. In fiscal year 13, we brought in our marketing team, and we had folks actually going out on a regional basis and touching base with all of our dealers and working on ways to enhance sales, and we've seen some real benefits there. And then the revenues held pretty steady over the last 3 years. On the hunting side, you know, unlike a lot of other states across the nation, our hunting sales have been experiencing growth. And as you'll see on the participation side, what we're actually doing is we're selling more products to roughly the same people. And that plays into the director's concern about, you know, where's the end game here? How do we take on participation and get new folks out there in the field? Turning over to
just on that, do we have data, demographic data, on the average age of a fisherman and a hunter, or median?
Yes, we do.
Do you know that?
Not off the top. I think it's similar. Peter, can you help me with that one? This is Peter Verney.
Hi, Peter. Good morning, Chair Smith and Commissioners. Our largest age demographic is 50 to 55. Like a lot of other states, we've seen that age up as we go along. Again, we have a real opportunity in the 20 to 32, 33-year age range. That is actually right peaking up a little bit, but that's our growth area. That's where we really need to focus our attention to and try to bring folks, keep them engaged or bring them back to the activities. But our customer base is definitely maturing, and it's right now it's 50 to 55, and in a couple years it'll be 55 to 60.
Yeah, because at the WAFA meeting that Jim and I were at, they projected that out a few years where it falls off the cliff.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research around that, and it's really right around the 70-year age mark where you see a real big drop.
Yeah.
Folks are getting out of hunting, and we're not bringing folks in at the younger age, and 10 years from now, we will face a real challenge to look at how we are going to fund wildlife agencies, not only in Washington State, but across the nation, because license sales will not be there. The participation will not be there.
And 10 years is not that far away.
Right around the corner.
Which adds even more importance to the task force that we were just talking about. And because when I saw that graph at WAFA, it's pretty stark, yeah. You know. And like, these numbers are going to go.
Yeah. They'll take a dramatic drop.
Have we ever looked at developing programs with the colleges and universities and community colleges? Because I would guess that there's probably some dropout during that period. You know, the kids have been out with their families, and then they get engaged, and I see it with bird watchers. Kids are active, and then they go off to college and have other things. So it might be an opportunity to communicate with some of our colleges and universities and see if we could set up clubs or whatever.
It's probably a great idea. Excuse me. But you know, since 2008, if anything, we've cut back on our outreach there, and it's an area we are going to have to look at probably as for the reasons Peter just laid out.
Yeah, well, we're looking at currently. We saw some stuff around in the Midwest where fishing clubs in colleges are becoming active again.
Joe, those are walleye clubs, by the way.
Walleye.
Yeah, walleye.
But they're having competitions between schools, and so we've started to take a look. The marketing group has started taking a look at that and trying to introduce it, you know, to Eastern Washington or Central Washington State University and see if we can't get some stuff there. So there's a ton of opportunity, and I agree with you. I think that's the engagement point, is trying to, when we talk about reactivation, we need to talk about reactivation around the 24 to 25-year-olds that have just got out of college, actually have a job, have some income, and are starting to look to get back to what they did as a youth with their parents and stuff, and re-engaging those folks is going to be real important for us.
When I was meeting with Rob the other day from TU, he said one of the more active chapters was up at Western Washington University, and I volunteered to go talk with him and stuff like that. But I think we saw at UW with the recreational fishing course that many of us have participated in, which had like 100 students in it. So I think you're right, because you're not going to get magic that when all of a sudden somebody's 24, 25, they're going to start hunting and fishing. You have to have that phase in the interest. You got to hook them earlier, you know, and that's but as Joe said, that's where the money's been cut. But I think that's where us as commissioners can play roles as well. Well, thank you. I didn't mean to monopolize, but that number, I just, whenever I see charts like this, I have that one where it just falls off. And
so the backside, then, we've talked about some of this, but the other side of this sheet has actual participants, individuals who have bought products from us, and you can see that the fishing participation has dropped off slightly, although with some of the effort we're putting into marketing, the fishing derby this last year, very popular. We've sort of stabilized over the last 3 years. And the hunting side, it stayed relatively stable for the last 5 years, but, you know, need to find ways to keep it there or build it. So I thought you'd be interested in taking a look at this.
And this is something I think the legislature would need to see. I mean, when we're doing some of this, that with the other thing, Jim, where the line falls. You know.
Second piece I want to touch on. Just, I'm sorry.
I just have to bring up, remember when we had the youth council session, we brought youth leaders in for a couple days, and one of the most remarkable things I heard was the young woman was one of our youth leaders from Spokane, saying that she was embarrassed to talk about her passion for hunting because she thought it was going to stigmatize her with her peers in Spokane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and she was a passionate hunter, So we talked about ways of connecting youth that love hunting so that they won't feel alone and isolated. But that's a remarkable thing in our society now. And I think on the other side of the picture, I remember reading about Mitch Friedman in Conservation Northwest having taken up hunting as an adult, right, and become a very passionate hunter from an environmental perspective, motivated by conservation and getting cleaner, healthier meat to eat. And so there's different currents going on, but I think we need to be aware of some of the hurdles of keeping hunters, the pipeline.
One of those other hurdles, it's not just the non-hunter, which is fine. It's the anti.
The anti.
Right.
Yeah, that seems to be getting a foothold or beach hold, in more and more areas.
Right. Yeah. Just for the record, I've had to give Mitch some of my elk and deer because he hasn't been lucky the last couple of years. But he still likes to go out there and try. But the other thing that screams to me about this chart is that, from a hunting standpoint, 200,000 hunters.
Right, yeah.
Out of a state of how many million? I mean, this points back to the Blue Ribbon Panel. This points back to there's 200,000 hunters willing to pay for the recreation they enjoy. There's got to be a way. This is the Department of Fish and Wildlife. All the people that observe animals, that just like to see animals, that just enjoy the diversity of species we have, which is incredible. There's got to be a way, because otherwise that cliff will come and the 50 and 60-year-olds will fall off in buying licenses. And I'm afraid, unless we can really turn to financing a department that is for all species, whether you hunt them or not, it's going to be really a hard thing to do. 200,000 hunters. I always picture that the whole state hunts. No. there's just a slim amount of people that do.
Yeah.
Kind of following up on Miranda's comments, I often find in talking to the non-hunting constituents that they think they're anti-hunting until you educate them a little bit about hunting and talk about the history of conservation among hunters and fishers, and then they realize it's not anti-hunting, they just don't hunt, but they are our allies. And I hope this is some of the work that comes out of this task force that we're putting together in terms of the outreach. There's a lot of education that needs to occur in both communities. Hunters need to be out when they run into a non-hunter talking to them, and explaining what they're out doing and bridging that communication problem.
Absolutely. Yeah, Joe.
Okay, I'll move through two other issues just real quickly. And for the audience, these handouts are out on the table there if you need them. You have a piece that looks like this, and the title is Work in Place. And what this is the amount of capital expenditures or capital work that's been done in the last three biennia. That's been completed either by contract with local contractors, so it's money in the community, or by our staff. And we're just real proud of the work, to improve infrastructure and wildlife areas, hatcheries. You saw the picture in the director's report that's taken place on the ground. And what you also see is the Jobs Now Act, emphasis that the capital budget, the funding that we got in our capital budget for all those kinds of activities, putting that out on the ground and increasing every biennia. And we're on track this biennia. The color coding, I should have made these in color, but the bottom line is the 11-13 biennium, the middle is the 13-15, and the top is the 15-17. So we're increasing dollars on the ground and capital improvements every biennia, and hope to keep that moving forward. So,
which I interpret to mean that we are fulfilling the goals set in the Burke report to actually spend the money that is appropriated to us?
That's part of it. Yeah, the Burke report, which came out about 10 years ago now, one of the things that we were criticized for was reappropriating too many dollars every biennium. We weren't putting money on the ground. And so we've made a number of improvements, gone to a project management scheme. We've got a lot more tools than we had before. And we're using private contractors where our staff aren't available, and working with the unions to do that. So, yes.
Great. Good news.
Then the last piece is you have this, I think, nice-looking brochure in front of you. And wanted you to see that as we're continuing to recruit for our enforcement chief. And to help with that, we've hired a professional recruiter. And that's CPS HR Consulting. And they are out now beating the bushes for additions to our hiring pool. And February 28th is the first closure where we'll look and see how many applicants we have. We have existing applicants that can be part of this too. But hopefully someone out there with attention on a daily basis nationwide. I know there's been inquiries from the East Coast and from Alaska already. And so trying to build that pool up so we can make a selection. And I guess I would also just take a second to thank the existing leadership in the enforcement program, Chief Anderson and both the deputy chiefs for keeping the ship, you know, stable and keeping things moving forward as we go through this process. But I wanted you to see the brochure.
All right. Well, one final thing Eric reminded me of. I wanted to draw to your attention that the state of Washington is we are the site for the North American, is it Fish and Wildlife Conference? I can't think of the whole question. We always call it the North American. But it's the North American Fish and Wildlife.
Commissioner and Director, that's correct. So you're familiar with the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, AFWA or AFWA, however you pronounce it. And they have lots of committees. And usually the annual meeting is sponsored by the host state. And it's a big deal for the state to have that occur. But the mid-cycle meeting is the Wildlife Management Institute sponsorship of the North American Wildlife Conference. And it occurs around the country, but they're sort of in charge of it, and that's what's happening in Spokane. So it's the same, and the same committees meet, but a little bit different, where we're not necessarily leading the charge. So it's happening in our backyard, and we asked the different programs, you know, how much would you normally spend to send people to this meeting if it was offsite, and if you contributed that instead, we could become platinum sponsors, which is what you're leading into.
Right. So we are platinum sponsors. So what that means is that any staff or the commission could attend this meeting and have the entrance taken care of. It's March 4th through the 11th at the Davenport in Spokane. You can get online and look this up, and it's a pretty interesting agenda. But there are some, it gives you a national feel for some things. And so I would guess, since you're right there,
if you could go.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I
can
know
we
about
stay at
it.
Your house?
Yeah, right. If there's a roof.
Anyway, I wanted to draw this to people's attention because it is kind of a neat thing that they chose Spokane to have.
And I do know that we're looking for field trips. This department is working on that. So.
And the only thing I would ask is they've asked that we provide names so that they can provide registration information, and you can get your name card if you check in. So through my program, we're documenting that and providing the list to WMI. So if commissioners are interested in going, waived registration, just let me know and we'll get you on the list.
And the national is in 2 years, is also going to be in Washington.
We're one of the choices, yeah. Has it been firmed up more?
That's what I was told by the conference coordinator.
Yeah, I know she was looking at Washington. So if that's the case, we'll...
That they needed a site that could accommodate 400 rooms, within an hour of Seattle.
So there, so annually there's three big wildlife meetings. Well, for us, there's the WAFWA, which is the Western Association, and then AFWA, the Association of the National Association, and then the North American is the Wildlife Management Institute's version of that. And so those are kind of big national meetings we're hosting. So if you're interested, please let me know, and I'll help you figure out what parts of the meeting might be interesting for you to attend. And with that, that was kind of a long-winded director's report.
Any final questions? Or okay, we'll just move right along then.